Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. There are so many digital tools available these days that can be helpful to teach your kids about money, but where do you start? Like, which ones are actually going to work? Robin Taub is an author. Her book's The Wisest Investment. She has spent a very long time focused on kids and financial literacy. She's also a chartered professional accountant. She'll be here to talk about some of the most popular family finance apps in Canada. Then, tax laws in this country treat different demographics differently, sometimes for good reason, and other times not. Single Seniors for Tax Fairness is an advocacy group based in Toronto, and it's looking to raise awareness about some of the inequities they argue single seniors face. Jane Robertson is the founder of the group. She's here to talk about it. And applying for the disability tax credit. Some people who use consultants to do that can pay pretty significant fees, but a proposed fee cap on these consultants has been suspended for now. Jamie Gollenbeck is the Managing Director of Tax and Estate Planning at CIBC. He's here to talk about where things stand in Canada. Then, getting a piece of the pie, the Canadian Employee Ownership Coalition is hoping to bring more awareness to the idea of employee ownership. John Schell from the organization is here to tell us more about what they're asking for. Plus, I'll speak to Colin Coggins. He's a prof from the Marshall School of Business in the U.S. He co-authored a book called The Unsold Mindset, Redefining What It Means to Sell. And the truth is, all of us are selling. We're all selling something. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. And what I'm selling is helping you get a better handle on your money so you can live the life you want. Let's get started. Tax season is probably not something you're looking forward to, unless maybe you're an accountant and this is your true passion. But for single seniors, paying taxes can be an even bigger frustration for a whole bunch of reasons. Single Seniors for Tax Fairness is a Canadian advocacy group that is looking to address the inequities it says this demographic faces. Jane Robertson is the founder of the group. She joins us now to tell us more. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
You yourself are a single senior and you've been retired for some time?
Retired at 62 and I'm now 85. So that's okay. A lot of retirement years.
You're an experienced retiree.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you define senior singles?
All right. Our group encompasses everybody who does not have a life partner who is over 65. So that includes widows, widowers, lifelong singles like me. That's my state. Divorcees and people who are separated.
And let's talk about some of the examples here about the circumstance that you find yourselves in versus the circumstance for someone who is still coupled.
Yes.
What are some examples?
The first case in our documents really says it all. A woman who has a retirement income, no, pension income of $115,000, and she gets most of her OAS clawed back because it's such a hefty income that she's got. And she goes to her financial planner and says, what can I do about getting more OAS? And he says, nothing. You're single. You have no flexibility at all. And then he says, just out of interest, let's pretend you had a partner. And that $115,000 was coming into the household. And it was the only income for the household. That means you and your partner will each declare incomes of $57,500. So half of the $115,000. As a result of that, you each qualify for full OAS, old age security payments, which means in the vicinity of $8,000 each. Plus, you will have the benefit of age credit because you will each declare less than $90,000. So that's another couple of thousand dollars or one and a half or so. And also, you will pay much less tax. You will pay exactly $21,000 less tax than this single woman is currently paying. So that is a portrait of the inequities that exist in terms of finances and taxes.
And you flag the other dynamic that a single person does not have half the expenses. It's you say two thirds, but it's certainly not half. The other variable you highlight is home ownership. How does that link to a single senior? Because as I read it, I think of that being certainly an issue, but an issue distinct from whether you are coupled or not.
You know what? You're right. You're absolutely right. I have a ton of single friends who are in the vicinity of my age, and I think every one of them owns a home. I think I'm the only one who is a lifelong renter because, to be honest, I've never wanted a home particularly. I mean, I've always been alone, which is not an ideal situation, but why would I want 10 rooms to walk around in instead of three or four? But that is a whole separate issue. What we use the idea of home ownership for is a comparison point, because we do say, people who own homes have a whack of money that they have an asset that is totally tax-free, whereas I am penalized because I don't have a home. The only tax-free asset I have is a TFSA, whereas the homeowner has this fabulous increase by thousands every year, plus, and sometimes that's millions, plus their own tax-free assets.
We know when we look at the mortality tables that it is more likely that you will be a single senior female, because women tend to last longer than men.
Right.
Your website and your material doesn't really put a fine point on the gender dynamic at play here, but I think it's important that we talk about it. How do you see gender coming into play here? Because we know that in their working years, a woman working alongside a man for generations would have earned 80 cents, 60 cents, whatever the number is, on the dollar versus a male peer.
Well, to be honest, we like to treat men and women equally when it comes to the position of seniors. You're absolutely right. By the time you get up into the senior category, sort of 70s and 80s, there are double the number of single seniors, single female seniors, than men in that stage, because men do die earlier. But, you know, we just don't want to make a distinction here. I mean, I think maybe we would get further with the government, because the government is very much pro-female, and which is fine. But, you know, I think there's a big case to be made for men. All you have to do is look at the homeless population. There aren't too many women in the streets compared to the number of men, et cetera. Anyway, yes, you're right.
I think it's an important dynamic, because one of the other case studies you had was Susan and Jill. Susan was married, then bought a house. Jill did not marry. She did not buy a house. She ran a small business, but she Jill did work. She could have bought a house. She didn't, but she could have.
Yes.
And she didn't have the expense of raising the kids that Susan and her then husband had. So I think one of the challenges is, where do the demographics end and the choices begin? Because Jill made some choices.
She did. And Jill, it just so happens, a sideline to that is that Jill, although she has no children of her own, is very much attached to three nieces and a two nieces and a nephew, three of them, children of an immigrant mother who came from the poorest of the poor in one of the Caribbean countries, had never had a day of schooling, she arrived here signing her name with an X. She couldn't even write her own name. Jill has, that's where Jill's money has gone. She has supported that family. She made a down payment on a house for them. She sent the kids to camp. They lost the house because of the marriage situation that they were in. So Jill has been paying rent. And prior to that, she paid mortgage fees. She sent the kids to camp. She helped pay for their tuition in community college. They're all in their late 20s, right, early 30s now, and big successes on their way to a nice middle-class life. They're not going to, she sent them to camp. She sent them, took them to ski lessons. And Jill is very happy that that's how she did spend her money.
Single Seniors for Tax Fairness is the name of your group. We just have a minute or two left. What is the call to action here? Who are you trying to influence and what do you want them to do?
Okay, well, the ultimate call to action is directed towards the government, the federal government, whom we want to give equal rights to. The government gives so many pluses like income splitting to, and also the other thing is transfer of portfolios like TFSAs and RIFs and so forth. There are major benefits to being a couple. And once those people lose a partner, that's when they awaken to the fact that their tax bill is going to be horrendous. They can't pass on their RIF payments to a family member, et cetera, et cetera. Their RIF portfolio, I should say. So all we're asking for, since the government is so reluctant always to withdraw all the benefits it gives to certain groups, what we're asking for is equality. It is why are we, without a partner, being penalized because we don't have a partner? Because that's really the bottom line of the whole argument, of the whole situation.
I understand where you're coming from, Jane, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come and let us know about the work that you are doing on this front.
Oh, thank you very much, Bruce.
Jane Robertson is the founder of a group called Single Seniors for Tax Fairness, and their mission is to try and eventually and over time lead to changes in the way taxes are handled in this country.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The disability tax credit can go a long way to reducing the burden for a family dealing with the costs of a family member with a disability. But it is not easy to get the DTC approval. The logistics can be complicated, and some people turn to consultants for help, services that command fees. There is something called the Disability Tax Credit Promoters Restriction Act, and we're going to talk about that, but also this broader question of how you resource people who can help you get the disability tax credit and take advantage of those benefits that the government offers. Jamie Golomek is the Managing Director of Tax and Estate Planning with CIBC Private Wealth Management. He's in Toronto. Hello there.
Hi.
How do you define the disability tax credit? And I guess more specifically, for whom does it make sense?
Well, the disability tax credit is quite a valuable credit. It's available both federally and provincially or territorially, depending on when you live. And it's available to help people with the costs of extra expenses they might incur as a result of the disability. So it is a valuable credit. It's available every year that you have that disability. And there's a whole variety of disabilities that could be applicable. Things from someone who is, for example, blind, someone who's deaf, things like that, including a much more complicated diagnosis of mental functioning, things like that. So there's a broad spectrum of canes that may qualify. But if you do qualify and you are certified by a medical practitioner, which we can talk about, then yes, this is a valuable credit. And for some people, it could last their entire lifetime.
Wow. Can you give us a basic sense for how much this is worth? So for parents with kids with exceptionalities, the interventions that they may require, many of which are not covered, could be in the thousands and thousands, maybe tens of thousands of dollars. What could the disability tax credit mean in dollar terms at its best?
Sure. So, again, it does vary slightly by province. So if we take BC as an example, federally, it's worth the same everywhere. So for 2023, the credit's worth $1,400. And then in, for example, in BC, he'd add another about $450 to that. So I'd say on average, depending on the province, it ranges anywhere from, let's call it, $1,700, $1,800. Mm. And it can actually go as high as $3,000 in Alberta. So it really depends on where you live. This is an annual amount. It can also be transferred to a supporting person if that individual doesn't have enough taxes payable to get the full credit. One other thing I think it's important to point out is that eligibility for the disability tax credit is also a gateway to open up an RDSP, a registered disability savings plan. And that's much more valuable because that disability savings plan allows you to save for an individual with a disability over a long period of time, grow that money completely tax-free, but also take advantage of government grants and government bonds. That could be another $70,000 of grants, $30,000 of bonds. I mean, this is a very valuable program, but it's only available if you qualify for the disability tax credit.
And the onus is on the applicant to make the case that they qualify, and it's not simple. It's not like, it's available to left-handed people and I can prove that I'm left-handed. There is a medical practitioner, as you say, there's a bunch of paperwork. Give us the essence of that application process and what, I have no idea if this number is available, what percentage of applicants might get the yes?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. We don't have that percentage. That's kind of a guarded secret. I mean, I think they have published stats over the years on that, and it does vary year by year. But look, I mean, in some cases, it's very, very straightforward. I mean, if you have a clear disability and there's no gray area, then, really it's just a matter. You can fill out the form yourself. You can go online to the Government of Canada's website. You can just Google Disability Tax Credit, Government of Canada. It's going to be the first page there. They've just actually fixed the whole form recently, like in the last year, that you can actually apply digitally. Which is really great. So again, very straightforward disability. Let's say someone is completely blind or completely deaf, and you can get a medical practitioner to say that, you're not going to have a problem doing this on your own, right? Just filling out the form, getting the doctor to certify the medical portion, and then getting this approved. Where it gets much more complicated is when you have other types of disability, particularly on mental functioning. Mm. And that's where you get areas of, people with ADHD or autism or, things like that, where there are more gray areas. And that's where, sometimes you need to reach out to a professional, whether that's an accountant or a lawyer that specializes in disability services, or in some cases, some of these specialty companies that have been advertising, in the last decade or so, that they will help you navigate these more complex gray cases through the system in return for a fee.
And I feel conflicted about this category of service providers, because on the one hand, I'm sure there's a market for people who can't or don't navigate the path themselves. I don't love that that is a percentage versus, if you pay an estate lawyer to do your will or an accountant to file your taxes, it's a fixed fee, it's transparent, you pay it and you move on. What's your sense for how this world of consultants and contingency fees works?
Yeah, certainly it's a complex area, and there certainly are views on both sides. And we saw that recently with a court challenge, where in fact the law was tried to change to limit the amount of fees that these providers could provide. In many cases, I believe that the typical contingency fee is 30% of what you could recover. And don't forget, it's not just 1 year. You have the ability to go back and get 10 years worth of credits at one time. So if you're talking, $2,000 a year for 10 years, that's $20,000. If they're taking a 30% fee, that's substantial. That's $6,000. So in some cases, for sure, they're doing that kind of work where it's complicated and where you don't know. But I mean, sometimes the cases are, again, as I said, much more straightforward. And a person may have been able to either apply on their own or, have an accountant help them just fill out with the basic form with their medical practitioner. So look, it is complicated. The act is suspended in terms of limiting the fee right now because the courts did take a look at this. The Vancouver court, the BC Supreme Court took a look at this back in the fall of 2011, and there was actually a court injunction that says, look, there's a serious issue here that needs to be resolved. before we can limit the amount that people can charge. So, you know, the arguments on both sides are there. Some people say, look, there are people providing a valuable service. They need to make a living. They need to be paid, you know, a fair amount for their services. On the other hand, we know that in some cases, persons with disabilities sometimes are more vulnerable. And therefore, this legislation was really meant to prevent, you know, people taking advantage of people who are vulnerable, who otherwise might be able to have completed the form on their own.
These costs, as I mentioned, could be a couple thousand, could be tens of thousands. Does the applicant, are they required to demonstrate that they are incurring additional cost, or does the credit live outside of the additional expenses they incur?
So the credit has nothing to do at all with the amount of expenses they incur. So this is just a pure credit. If you qualify because you have a long-term disability, and that's defined specifically with the, one of the basic activities of daily living, you can get all those details online, then you automatically get this credit. It's right on the tax return. It reduces the tax you pay. Or if you don't pay any tax, that could be transferred to certain family members.
One last question. If you had a friend of a friend who had no resources, they didn't have enough credit in the emotional bank account to ask you to help them, would you guide them towards a consultant like this? Or would you say they should, you know, spend the time, learn how to do it, follow through and do it themselves?
Again, I think it would depend on the type of disability this individual had. If I thought it was a very straightforward case, I would certainly either try to help them, or I would direct them to maybe a local accounting firm or someone that, you know, specializes in taxes where they could do it, or maybe a friend or family member. If it is one of those more gray areas where it's just more complex and there's maybe multiple disabilities that in turn add up to a significant disability that impairs daily living, then I may suggest they may want to seek out the advice of one of these consulting firms.
Really interesting stuff. Jamie, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jamie Gollenbeck is Managing Director, Tax and Estate Planning with CIBC Private Wealth in Toronto. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll speak with a chartered professional accountant and author about some of the most popular family finance apps available in Canada these days. Her name is Robin Todd. And later, owning a stake in your company, John Schell from the Canadian Employee Ownership Coalition tells us about some of the benefits that he would argue would be available for employees if this idea was embraced here in Canada. If you want some more Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca. You will find past episodes that are searchable both by guest name and by topic. You can also get archived shows on all of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen to podcasts. Write a review while you're there, maybe even subscribe so it'll arrive right on your device.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Financial education is important. It is so important for our kids in particular. And in today's nearly cashless society, there's an added complexity because everybody's tap, tap, tapping. No one's counting coins. Almost no one is counting coins. Robin Tobe is a chartered professional accountant. She is the author of The Wisest Investment, which if you don't have it, is a book for kids and financial literacy, and you should have it. And she joins us to talk about some of the most popular family finance apps in Canada. Hello, Robin.
Hey, Bruce.
So I am self-interested in this question. As you know, I have a young person in my house. They are 13. We are amazing on all things allowance, but we're starting to age out of the jars. So they still, still do the jars. They still take the cash. But when they go for Thursday lunch, there will be a time soon in which a debit card makes sense. The bank doesn't really have anything. So we're going to talk about some specific apps that are really customized. But in the absence of going that route, what should we expect from the banks where our kids' accounts are held?
Right. Well, most of the big banks in Canada do have a youth account, which is an account designed for young people. It doesn't really pay them much in the way of interest, but they're also very low in fees, or they have no fees. Right. And usually it comes with a physical debit card. And that debit card will allow them to withdraw and deposit cash at the ATM. It will let them make in-store purchases and basically be a little more independent when they're out and about, as they tend to be at that preteen stage, like you said, 13.
Can I, as the parent, transfer money? Can I see what they're spending that on, in particular vapes? No vaping at our house yet, but you know, I want to be aware.
So usually, because, you know, a 13-year-old is below the age of majority, which is 18 or 19 in most provinces and territories, a parent or legal guardian has to go with them to open this account. And so they're usually, as a parent, you're still somewhat involved with it. So yes, it is like a functioning bank account. So you can deposit as a parent, you can transfer funds to this account. And I find some banks let you set up a personal payee, so you can do it that way. You could probably do it through Interac as well. And as I said, it's like, just like your debit card, they can go to the store, they can tap, they can buy things, and they can also go to the machine and withdraw cash if they're using it.
So there are some apps out there that are really customized to kids. The first one for us to talk about is Mido. Tell us about the features here.
Okay, so Mido is from RBC, and I'm just making sure, I just want to get it all right. So this, I mean, let's just talk about what these apps and cards do and are. So instead of it being a youth account with a physical debit card, think of it as a kind of like a gift card. So they call it a prepaid virtual Visa debit card. Okay. And I know that sounds really confusing, but think of it like a gift card. So it has to be loaded by someone, usually the parent. And unlike your debit card, where the money comes out of your account right away, this just, every time you use it, you draw the balance down until there's nothing left. And once it's, you know, once it's down to zero, it stops working. So you can't go into overdraw like you could on a regular bank account.
Right.
So think of it like a gift card. So my understanding is that you cannot deposit checks or cash into the account. You can't use the ATM. You can't withdraw cash. It's just like a gift card. Okay. So, but what's cool about it is that it has some additional features. Like the parents can monitor their children's spending. They can react to their spending with emojis. So like a sad face or mad face for vaping or whatever. And like, you know, maybe a happy face.
It'd be more than a sad face. I'll tell you that right now.
It'd be the steaming mad face. You can assign chores. You can monitor, you know, whether chores are being done. You can pay their allowance all through the app. And there is a 30-day free trial, but then there is an ongoing monthly fee associated with using the app. And I think it's lower for RBC customers, but and higher for non-RBC customers, but it could be used if you don't have an account with RBC.
So Robin, one of the other apps that's kind of purpose built for this is called Wallow.
Right.
Wallow? What is it? I'm wallowing.
It's called Wallow. Like Wallow. I think of it like wallet.
Okay. Yeah. It sounds like wallowing in the fact that I don't have enough money, but I didn't brand it.
It's W-A-L-O. And it's, so it's similar in the sense that it's like a gift card. It's a prepaid virtual Visa debit card. And that means you can also spend online. With these prepaid virtual debit cards, you can use it almost like a credit card. So it does include like in-app purchases or online purchases, whereas normally a debit card cannot be used that way. But again, it has to be loaded. Parents can monitor spending and they can assign allowance and chores. And then there's an educational component that's gamified. MyDo also has an educational component to help teach kids about money, and so does Wallo. The Wallo one is a little more gamified, I believe. So there's quizzes and kids can earn like badges and that kind of thing. So while they're in the app spending and checking things, they can also learn about proper money management.
What about iAllowance? What's that one?
So that one is only available for Apple devices, and they have a free version, which tells me that there's not as much functionality. It's not going to be as robust as the fintech apps we just talked about, like MyDo and Wallo. But it does let you create and track chores and set reminders and automate the allowance. And there is like a version that you pay for that is, I think it's just a one-time cost of $4.
Okay. And Treasure.
And Treasure is for teenagers specifically. Like the other apps we talked about were kind of all ages, maybe starting at around 4 or 5. This one is for teens. Again, there's a free version or a version that costs about $4 a month. And this one is similar to the ones we discussed, an app and a prepaid card. And it features things like chore management, tracking, spending, setting goals, and allowance. So I think you just need to kind of compare all these different apps and see which one best suits how you plan to use it and if you want to pay for it or not.
It's interesting because as we go through these, I think, as meh as I am about my bank's approach to their youth account, it kind of feels like that's the way for me to go, to wrap around the education, which I do at dinner and breakfast and lunch and bedtime, with some other monitoring things that I think are important as they learn to use money as a tool.
Yeah, I mean, that's more the do-it-yourself model where you're cobbling it together. And as an expert yourself, I'm sure that that will work for you and your family. You know, it may be easier for some parents who aren't as comfortable talking about money to have some of this education built in like it is in MyDo and Wallo. But as we pointed out, there are some other differences in how these accounts actually work. And I think that the youth accounts are more akin to a regular bank account. And yes, you could still sit down with your child, log in either on their phone or online and look at the transactions and go over everything with them and see where they've been spending money. And they, if they're spending too much, you can just discuss, you know, needs and wants and all that. But I think what's interesting to know too, is that with these debit account, these debit cards, you can still set daily spending limits. You can still choose how the card can be used. Like you can say that it cannot be used at an ATM, or you can limit withdrawals at the ATM or at certain stores. Like you can limit the spending at specific stores. You can also lock the card online or via the app if it gets lost or misplaced. So there's still ways to really keep on top of your child if they just have like a good old physical debit card and a youth account.
Yeah. And I'm realizing that I think we'd need to separate into two accounts because we have an investing structure in our family where Asher receives compounding, and I wouldn't want them to have access to that money because they'd be susceptible to spending it.
Well, that's a whole other lesson, right? Which is the importance of paying yourself first and saving and segregating it. So you're right. Having some kind of account where they're saving for longer term goals is still really important. And I think MyDo has a savings and a goals component to it, which they've just added. So people may want to check that out. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to take in with this stuff and a lot of confusing terminology, even for us.
And a lot of change and innovation. Robin, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Okay, Bruce, thank you.
Robin Taube, chartered professional accountant, the author of the book called The Wisest Investment. And we were talking about some of the apps and even the non-app ways we can help our kids live in this cashless society that we find ourselves in.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to John Schell from the Canadian Employee Ownership Coalition about why he believes employee ownership can benefit the Canadian economy. But first, what you need to know about becoming a great salesperson. Colin Coggins is a professor at the USC School of Business, and he co-authored a book called The Unsold Mindset, Redefining What It Means to Sell. I'm the money columnist for CBC Radio. I am selling financial health each and every day, but on Wednesdays, I'm on the air on CBC across Canada, and we talk about topics that are relevant to you and to your financial life. So maybe we can meet there too.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Selling is critical. Selling is critical to almost every job there is. You're selling your ideas, you're selling yourself, you're selling action. But what makes a great salesperson? And is it a skill that can be trained? Colin Coggins is a professor at USC Marshall School of Business and the co-author of The Unsold Mindset, Redefining What It Means to Sell. He joins us now to talk about the mindset and some misperceptions about selling. He's in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
I am well. I started my career in sales in a very traditional role, selling laundry detergent and other great packaged goods products at P&G, but I fit the stereotype. I'm extroverted. I am loud. Why does selling have such a bad name in so many quarters of our economy?
So what we've found is that when you ask someone what they think of, when they hear the word salesperson, they say yucky, manipulative, smarmy, et cetera. Yeah. But if you ask them who the greatest salesperson is they know, they give you names like Martin Luther King Jr., yeah. Steve Jobs, my son, my daughter. Yeah. And there's that incongruence there. And I think what's happening is that all day long, without even trying, people are pretending to be someone that they're not when they're in selling situations. It doesn't matter if they're interviewing for a job or they're trying to teach their kids something or if they're trying to get their, you know, significant other to watch season 3 of The Office versus season 2, which is obviously a better season.
Of course.
And so what we've realized is that the greatest salespeople on the planet, although they can be gregarious and extroverted, that's not their superpower. What they're really good at is being extremely self-aware. Like they could say something, realize it didn't land, and they're able to course correct real time. They can talk to someone and realize that the person doesn't think that they're listening. They think they're waiting to speak, and they can change immediately. And these are conversations that are being had at the highest levels. And sometimes, in fact, most of the time, the greatest salespeople in any room don't have sales in their title, but they're doing the best job ever, creating agency, helping people feel like they're part of the decision, and ultimately moving people. And I don't know how you chase dreams, your dreams or anybody else's dreams, if you don't know how to move people.
How do you define the unsold mindset? What do you mean by that phrase?
So we went out and interviewed some of the greatest sales professionals that are living. And then we asked them who are the greatest salespeople they knew. And they all introduced us to people that were not sales professionals. And that was fascinating to us. And as we dug in, what we realized was that what they all had in common had nothing to do with what they were saying or what they were doing. It was what they were thinking. They were unsold on who society expected them to be as a salesperson, as a CEO, as a mother, et cetera. They were unsold on who people wanted them to be. They were unsold on who they had to be successful. So they weren't these like rule breakers intentionally. They just looked at themselves and their careers and their impact, and they based it against what everyone thought it was supposed to look like and truly believed that the opposite was true.
Chapter 1 is titled, You Can't Act Authentic. Come on, give me a raw onion in 30 minutes and I can muster a tear like anybody. What do you mean you can't act authentic?
By definition, you can't act authentic. because you can't, like, you're acting, right? Mm-hmm. And by definition, authenticity is not acting. Authenticity is your authentic self. That doesn't mean that you can't have multiple authentic selves, but what it does mean is that when you act like you are authentic, there's only a matter of time before people realize, it's called schemer schema. It's like this, I think, this physical gut reaction that's actually backed up by science. People know when you're faking it. They might not know right away, but they know. And so when we were out there talking to these people, we realized that they were giving themselves permission to share pieces of themselves that most people wouldn't. And I give you a great example of this. Some of the unsold, a lot of them, they were intentionally ignorant about the pieces of their job and their work that didn't inspire them to show up passionately or authentically. So they would literally ignore these pieces of their jobs to create the infrastructure to mitigate inauthenticity. Or we would talk to people and ask them about their lives and their jobs and their careers, and they would start talking to themselves out loud. They would say things like, wow, that's a really good question. Let me think about that. And then they'd look back at us. And those 3 seconds, right, that micro moment of connection where they were showing their work, like in math class, like they don't just show their answer, they show their work. You can't act authentic when you're showing your work. Mm. A lot of people want to talk about the right side of the equal sign. This book is about the left side of the equal sign, why these great sellers think the way they do. And authenticity is, I think, the byproduct of that.
And as you were doing your research, what did you learn about what of this can be trained and what is, it's a character trait, it's a temperament, it's a value, it is, you know, just who that person is?
I love this question because there's a debate on if, you know, you can raise IQ, but there's no real debate on if you can raise EQ because it comes with experience. Like your self-awareness, for example, is heightened as you go through experiences. And so when we were looking at all of these different people, what we realized, what they were really good at proving to everyone that's going to read this book, there's no right way to be good at selling. There's this whole duality between, like, is a great seller optimistic or pessimistic, an introvert or an extrovert? Are they logical? Are they emotional? Are they a learner? Are they a knower? Like these conversations that kept popping up, and we realized the answer was yes. Like they actually run the gamut. And I don't know if that's answering your question directly, but duality was one of the most surprising things that we just fell in love with as we were writing this book.
What is an example of a great sales question? Because I think you've talked a lot about listening and who you're being while you have that conversation. And then there's also what falls out of your mouth. So can you give me an example of a great sales question?
I can. I want to tell you how much I love this question, because what great sellers, especially the unsold that are represented in this book, do really well is they add value by asking questions, which is very rare. Most of the time you're extracting value when you ask questions. Tell me, show me, give me. And these great sellers, like, they are asking questions that people have never heard before. And so what's happening is these people are ideating for the first time in real time about what that answer is. And whatever the answer is to that question, that's their answer. They weren't sold on that answer. They took ownership in that answer. They bought that answer because it was theirs. And that's this concept of agency that's really, you know, fleshed out a lot throughout the book. If I give you an example, one of the best questions that we've heard from students in our class that they use during the interview process when they're selling themselves and their ideas is, what rules should we be breaking? One of our favorites.
Wow. I love that. Speaking of duality, the salesperson needs to sell the thing, but in the land of authenticity, they have to kind of be detached from selling the thing, because not everybody needs the thing. And what might arise in the conversation is, oh, you don't need the thing. Okay, moving on. But great salespeople have a way to engage on the objections such that the person they're selling to can kind of answer the question for themselves and hopefully in their favor. What did you learn about how great salespeople handle objections?
No. Now I know you were a salesperson. the biggest key takeaway is that people will say no to you because you're right. Mm. Like, people will say no to you because you handle the objection so well. You know, like you handled every objection, you answered all their questions, you fit within the budget. They said that they were going to spend the money, and now you're asking to buy and they're saying no. And the question is, why are they saying no if I handled every single objection? And the answer is because you're right. And it's this concept that most people don't talk about in sales, which is the difference between being a knower and a learner. And we were interviewing people. They were telling us that they would get more credit from customers for saying, I don't know, and then going out and being resourceful and fighting for those people and those answers. And this idea of know-it-allism and belief superiority, it stems from this belief that you're supposed to know everything. But I can't tell you how many people in this book say that their three favorite words are, I don't know. Because it gives them the opportunity to go and fight, to go and bring someone else in, and then put that person on a totally completely different team. Like if I say, I don't know, but I know somebody smarter than me that does, hold on, I will go and fight and get this person in the room. When that person comes in the room, it's now me and you on one side of the table and that person on the other, and we want to know something. So, objections are hard, but I think that know-it-allism and creating a sense of agency versus stripping agency, meaning like don't overcome every objection so that people don't feel like they're part of the process. People will say no because they don't feel like they're part of the process. Create agency so they feel like they are part of the process because they actually are.
One last question. You could wake me up at 2 a.m. and I would be able to recount to you the Procter & Gamble sales format. It was so ingrained in our brains. To that end, what is the single most important thing a salesperson needs to prepare before they walk into that room?
My co-author, Garrett Brown, is going to kill me for dropping the L-bomb on you, but I'm going to do it.
Okay, I'm ready.
Falling in love. And I know it sounds cheesy, so I want to preface this.
Yeah, you did nothing to end the stereotype of salespeople right there. Jeez.
You know, everyone knows who's listening, that you move differently when you're enamored with someone. Now, it's impossible for you to take 3 minutes to fall in love with someone before you walk in that room. But there's this entire theory that we have seen proven accurate throughout this entire book, that if you look for the good in someone, you will find it. And when you ask someone to look for the good in someone, if you ask someone fall in love with the idea of who this person could be, what they're actually doing is they're looking for themselves in these people. And if you can see yourself in someone when you talk to them, it's not an adversarial relationship. You are asking questions that most people don't because you care differently. Like Garrett, I always make fun of him on stage. Like my co-author, I say the best version of him was the 14-year-old version of him when he had a crush on somebody.
Right.
He didn't talk more. He talked less. He actually thought the stuff that was coming out of her mouth was funny when everybody else didn't.
Right.
So, net, there's a very, I believe, beautiful and special chapter called Fall in Love, or Love Actually. Fall in Love, comma, actually.
I love that movie. Colin, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your book. It is called The Unsold Mindset, Redefining What It Means to Sell. Again, thanks for being here.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk to John Schell. He is a member of a coalition calling on the government to create an employee ownership trust. What does that mean? What does that mean to you? Don't forget, we have a newsletter, super simple to stay up to date on all the things that that I do on this show, on CBC Radio, on CityLine, on BNN Bloomberg. To sign up for that newsletter, you go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Wouldn't it be nice to own a share of the company you work for? Well, I guess it depends on the company, but let's say it's a great company with a great future. You might be interested in owning a piece, maybe in employee ownership. But the policies needed for this to really work in Canada aren't in place. The nonprofit Canadian Employee Ownership Coalition is hoping to change that. It's hoping to bring the benefits of employee ownership to a broader audience here. John Schell joins us now to talk about the idea and how it would work. Hello there.
Hi there.
I used to work for a big multinational, and there was a stock ownership plan, which they were very keen on us participating in,
right,
because they believed it was a good investment and it was great for employee engagement. That is not possible for small businesses because they're not publicly traded. How would you explain employee ownership outside of the model where they prompt you to buy shares on the public market?
It actually is possible if it's done in a way like you did at the multinational. So right now, employee ownership in Canada is accessible, you know, if you buy shares from an owner, but you can only buy a certain amount, or through stock options like you might have had at your multinational company. But generally, those stock options end at like a minority shareholding, right? So you can end up having employees own 10, maybe 20% of the company, and that's great, you know. And we're, you know, that's a super supportive of that. We think it's useful. What we don't have in Canada is a structure to allow for employee ownership in a succession context, and that's where employee ownership really has taken off in the U.S. and the U.K. When an owner is looking to retire and is looking at their options to sell the company, in those countries, they can sell the whole company at once to their employees using debt without having their employees have to pay for it. And that's what has created this incredible program of improving wealth inequality in those countries, which actually are, you know, obviously very unequal. But these are very particularly particular programs in those countries that have been very successful. In the US, for example, there are 14 million Americans who own $1.7 trillion in the companies they work for using this, what they call an ESOP in the US, and they call an EOT in the UK, but these employee stock ownership programs where the owner has sold the company to their employees that is unavailable in Canada.
What would be required of our country to make that possible?
So the things that have made this successful in the US and the UK is, one, there has to be a structure, right? So there needs to be a trust structure in place in the Income Tax Act that allows for these things to happen. We do not have that in Canada today. The second are incentives. So if we think about the economy we want, you know, in the US and the UK, the politicians across the political spectrum have said, we want to see more employee-owned companies. They have wonderful outcomes, not just for worker wealth, but also for communities. They keep jobs in local communities. These companies tend to grow faster. They lay off fewer people in recessions. So there are tax incentives to encourage owners to sell to their employees, as opposed to, say, a private equity firm or a competitor. And then you need to ensure, in exchange for those tax incentives, that the employees get their shares for free and they go to all employees. And that's what's allowed, you know, there's a wonderful example of this in the US in the southeastern states called Publix. It's a grocery store. It's got about 200,000 employees. So it's roughly the size of Loblaws. And it's over 80% owned by their employees. And grocery clerks who've worked there for 30 or 40 years will retire with $1 million in their share account, right? Those are the outcomes that are just, that are unachievable here in Canada that have been wonderful success stories. Right. In the US. So those are the three things we need in Canada.
And certainly that example is of a successful company and they bought in at the right time. If a clerk were to buy in or get employee ownership today, there's nothing to say that in 30 years they would also have $1 million.
100%. So the key here is that the employees don't take on a risk themselves, right? So the thing we don't want is a system where employees are taking their, you know, money that they don't have. You know, these are generally employees don't have a ton of extra cash hanging around, especially these days. We don't want them taking that money and putting them into the company and then maybe losing all of that. The way these programs work is often it is a bank and the owner who fund the transaction, and then they are paid back out of company cash flow. So the employees themselves don't take on a debt risk, right? So it's all upside for the employees.
Right. What rights and responsibilities do they have in that context? Because if you own a share of a publicly traded company, depending on the class of shares, you get a vote.
So the way these work is they're owned through a trust. And that's partly what's made them successful in the US and the UK, is that the trust itself has a trustee that votes the shares. So the employees themselves get beneficial ownership, right? So they get all of the benefit of future profits of the company, but they don't have a day-to-day different responsibility than they had before. The company continues to be run in the way it was. If you take a look at an example, like Taylor Guitars in the US, which is a 1,200 person, a wonderfully run company, very sustainable, sold to their employees last year with a really thoughtful management team, you wouldn't want the next day for it to be one member, one vote, right? So Taylor Guitars is still run by the same wonderful management team, but now the benefits of their growth will go to employees as opposed to their old owners.
What have you seen in other countries about the unionization of these firms? Because it would seem to me, having thought about it for about 4 seconds, that in some ways that might be inconsistent with a highly unionized environment.
So there are some very successful companies in the US that are both fully unionized and fully owned by the employees at the same time, right? So there's a grocery chain in Oklahoma that has done really well with that structure. In other cases, the union doesn't want to participate in employee ownership. And then there can be two programs, right? So they can exist side by side. Either way, the transition of a company to their employees is, you know, to the benefit of workers. So it's a worker-focused program. So we've generally had good support from the union movement because, you know, the outcomes are really good for workers. There are some cases, where a union already has secured that for their workers. So there wouldn't be much additional benefit for employee ownership, but these are designed for, you know, sort of 50 to 200 employee companies in the private sector. The vast majority are not unionized. And so there will be a lot of opportunity for these to provide benefits to workers that they don't already have.
What's the case against this here in Canada? If I had all the time in the world, I'd have a point counterpoint and someone else would say, this is a terrible idea, don't do this. What would they say?
You know, look, it's an interesting case. And I'll try to answer your question without these, people say, hey, what's your worst quality? I say, well, I'm a perfectionist. So I'm not going to try to answer it that way. What is true is that there tends to be broad support for these. So you get Bernie Sanders advocating for more tax incentives for ESOPs, and you get Ronald Reagan advocating for more tax incentives for employee-owned companies. In the UK, it was a coalition government that brought this in to begin with, that spanned both sides of the political spectrum. So there doesn't tend to be, this is one of those things where everyone says, yeah, this is a good public policy, and there doesn't tend to be a lot of disagreement. You just also don't get a bunch of people picketing out front of the, you know, parliament to bring this into place. So there generally is not a lot of argument against it. If one could say, hey, you're giving a tax incentive to owners here. So this is like, this can be used as some sort of tax shield, and we don't like that. And that's probably the strongest argument we get against it. And our response to that is, first, there's a bunch of rules you need to put in place to make sure that doesn't happen. And those are easy, you know, those are easy rules to implement. So this won't work like a tax shield in that way. And the second is the outcomes are generally so good for workers that the outcomes for society are good, right? So it is worth providing a tax incentive for this program as opposed to having companies owned by a foreign-owned private equity company, or you get a multinational come in and buy up all our companies. One great Canadian example. So there's a company in southern Manitoba, in Altona, Manitoba, called Friesens, which has been employee-owned for about 60 years here in Canada. They've done it using, you know, scotch tape and baling wire to try to deal with all the negative incentives there are in Canada. But there's no way that company, which employs 650 people in Altona, that's the biggest employer in town, would still be there if it wasn't employee-owned. And that's the reason why governments in other countries have been willing to provide these types of tax incentives to ensure the economy is more owned through employee ownership than other means.
Just before we go, what needs to be true about the mindset of the owner for them to pursue this path? Because I can imagine, and I'd say it's a majority of owners who would say, listen, this is my liquidity event. I am going to sell and I'll top bidder, and maybe it's private equity, maybe it's a competitor. It would maybe not be at the top of the priority list to make this plan available to employees. Yeah.
So in the UK, where they waive capital gains taxes for owners who sell to their employees, it still only comprises like 5 to 10% of transactions. So the vast majority of owners do what you just said, right? The question is, do we want it to be 0% of the economy, or do we want it to be 10% of the economy? And the 10% that chooses to do it, or the 5% that choose to do it, do tend to be community-oriented owners who have owned their companies for a long time, often built them up from scratch, have a real loyalty to their employees. And that's not everybody, right? This isn't for everybody. But for those owners, and of which there are a lot in Canada, and many of them have reached out to us over the last couple of years, we've been talking about this, saying this is something they'd be really interested in. For those owners, this allows them to transact their, you know, sell their company in a way that makes them feel much better about the legacy that they've built over the decades to come. But as you say, it's not for everybody.
Really interesting. Well, thank you for giving us a sense for what could be if you are successful in your quest.
Well, thanks. And look, and what could be is a lot, right? So the projections that we've seen suggest that 115,000 employees, could earn $8 to $9 billion in their companies over the next 8 years if we do this. And so, 5 to 10% is enough to be really meaningful in this economy.
John, thank you.
Thank you.
John Schell is with the not-for-profit Canadian Employee Ownership Coalition. Its focus is to bring the benefits of broader employee ownership to Canada. That's it for our show for today. Thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. To reach us, ask@moolala.ca is the email address. We look forward to hearing your comments, your questions, your story ideas, your feedback, all that stuff. You can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. On social media, I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.